This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over the backyard fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. Ada Calhoun's soulful investigation into the complex landscape women in midlife face today is downright stunning. Calhoun has captured the voices, some broken, some resilient, many barely staying afloat, of over 200 women from around the country, and in doing so, shown us how much we share in divisive times. This is a marvelous description by Susanna Cahalan of Ada Calhoun's Why We Can't Sleep. Ada is my guest today on The Literary Life, and I want to welcome you to The Literary Life, Ada.
Thank you for having me on. I listen to this podcast all the time. I love it very much.
Thank you. All of us know that you're the author of this fantastic book, subtitled Women's New Midlife Crisis. But I first got to know you when you wrote the book St. Mark's is Dead, which is a wonderful 400-year history of the New York City street where you grew up. And you've also written Wedding Toasts I'll Never Give. The way you stay married is simple, don't get divorced, which I think is brilliant.
Quote from my mother, who's very proud to have her words on the cover.
Needless to say, this your career, just even by the book titles that we've just mentioned, is very varied. Your writing is remarkable. And the way you approach reportage is in a way that you're basically kind of reinventing the style in a sense. Somewhere in the book you say that, I believe you say that you were born the year Passages came out. Was that you?
That's right, 1976.
In 1976. Mm-hmm. So Gail Sheehy also in her time kind of did a very similar kind of thing. So tell me how you came to Why We Can't Sleep and why you chose to write it now.
Well, I'm honored by the comparison. And it started with a story for Oprah.com. So I do a lot of freelancing for magazines. And I was having an absolutely terrible summer. This was in 2017. I had had a ton of freelance work fall through. I was like broke. And I was responsible for bringing in most of the money to the house. So I didn't know what we were going to do. And I felt really desperate. And this editor fortunately called and asked me to write about our generation. And I wound up writing this 6,000-word story that went pretty viral because it turned out there were a lot of other women like me.
So talk about those women like you. What were they experiencing?
Well, what we'd grown up hearing a lot was you can be anything you want, even president. Don't be a nurse, be a doctor. The world is your oyster. And all of these things that I think our mothers really wanted to be true for us. But the world did not change as much as they hoped it would to make those things possible. So what I heard from women now in their 40s was that they felt like big disappointments and failures, even if they were doing so much more in terms of work and caregiving than their mothers or grandmothers had.
Yeah, in the introduction, you quote Hilary Mantel, a wonderful quote, where you say, you come to this place midlife, you don't know how you got here, but suddenly you're staring 50 in the face. When you turn and look down the years, you glimpse the ghosts of other lives you might have led. All your houses are haunted by the person you might have seen or been, I should say. How do you think being and approaching midlife is different than what my generation, as the baby boom generation, might have approached it? Or how we approached it, I should say.
Yeah, well, one of my really good friends, who's a boomer, Caroline Miller, she hired me at New York Magazine many years ago. And I was talking to her when I was working on the article, and she said, it's so funny, your generation basically invented stress. Because she said when she accomplished all the things she accomplished, everyone was so surprised and so proud of her. Like, look at you, you're getting this amazing job and you're running all these magazines and it's incredible. And then she sees her own daughters, and every time they have an accomplishment, it feels like not enough. There's just this level of pressure and this sense that if you're not doing everything, doing it all perfectly, that you're failing. So that was what I was trying to capture, just that feeling, that sense of despair over not having done enough.
And certainly very different from how men approach midlife, right?
Well, it's funny.
You bring that out in the book as well.
There's so much about male midlife crises, and I think they've been given so much attention over the years by novels and by movies, many of them with Michael Douglas starring. And you know, there's the sports car, there's the girlfriend, there's all that stuff. And what I heard from so many women, and this I think is intergenerational, because I know that, you know, Gen X is not the first generation to have a hard time in midlife. This is when a lot of caregiving hits, menopause is no joke. But what I kept hearing was that for women, it's often so much quieter. That usually, because they have so much caregiving to do, they wind up sneaking in any kind of suffering around the edges.
It's true, and men are given some latitude that women are not given. In other words, yeah. Oh, it's only just a midlife crisis. You know, they're just acting out, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that probably bridges all the generations that and particularly women of the Gen X generation seem, and you brought it out in your book, they seem to be expected to do certain things. And I guess that's where the feeling that they didn't do enough comes from.
Yeah. So one
talk woman, specifically about some of the women.
Yeah. Well, so one woman after another told me that somewhere along the way, this idea that she could be anything morphed into this idea in her head that she had to do everything, that if she had a career but not a family, or a family but not a career, that she was a disappointment. And that even if she had both, which a lot of the women I talked to did, that somehow it wasn't enough if the children weren't all like champion gymnasts and her house wasn't sparkling clean and she hadn't made it to the corner office. So there was just this sense of nothing ever being enough.
Talk to me about, I know that this is a very personal book as well, and that's why I think it kind of bridges so many different genres. So talk to me a little bit about your own midlife crisis.
Yeah.
And how, I think somewhere in the book you say that this helped cure you to some extent as soon as you started hearing everyone else's stories and writing about it.
It really did. It helped so much hearing other women's stories, because I found that I wasn't alone, which it turned out was a huge part of the despair that I was feeling and a lot of the women that I talked to were feeling, was the sense that everyone else had it all figured out. And I think social media plays a big part in that. You look around and you think, oh, everyone else is somehow figuring out a way to have vacations and smile and look young. Why can't I do those things? And so I think that just the camaraderie of other women and being honest about the depths of their experience made a big difference to me. I really love this book.
You said you love, you know, we're recording this right in the bookstore at Books and Books. And the one thing Ada said when she said that she listened to some of the podcasts was,
yes, I always like the background noise.
Yes. We are literally right in the middle of it all.
Yeah, it makes me feel like I'm in Miami. I can close my eyes and pretend I'm in Coral Gables and not in New York City. So yes, my midlife crisis. I felt like I had a bunch of credit card debt. I felt like I had no job stability. I felt dumb for having gone freelance. But then again, I tried to find a corporate job and couldn't find any. And I thought, why, when I thought I did everything right and I've been working hard since I was 13, should this be so difficult? And then when I wrote the book, I found a lot of answers. Like, there are forces at work that are greater than us. And there's a reason why our generation has so much debt and so little job stability. And, you know, costs are extremely high. And a lot of us graduated into recessions. And one thing after the other pointed to some real extenuating circumstances that meant maybe it wasn't just that I had screwed up and that all these other women who were frustrated had screwed up.
You certainly didn't screw up. And neither did any of those others. You know, it's really funny. I have a sister who's younger than I am. She just squeaks in as a baby boomer. Uh-huh. She was born, I think, in 1963. Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting to me, because when she had read the book, and she was talking as if it was a completely different generation, even though it was only like 2 years different,
yeah,
which I thought was really interesting. The other thing that you do, which I think is your openness about this, I'd love you to talk about a little bit, and that is that you do recognize how different it is in different communities, among people of color,
yeah,
among people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. Talk a little bit about that and yeah, how you chose to deal with that in the book.
Well, that was something that was really important to me, because a lot of the books that I'd read about women of this age were usually just about a very small group of women, like women in Brooklyn, women in Los Angeles, and it was either like it was either white women or black women, or it was either rich women or poor women. And it was so narrowly focused. And then there was this claim being made at the same time that it was this universal thing. So what I tried to do was really identify the group I was talking about very clearly, which is middle-class women. I feel like I've done a lot of reporting on poor women, and the number of obstacles in their way is so great that I thought this book would be much longer. And then, you know, there's all these reality shows about rich women. So I feel like they're covered. But I feel like middle-class women have this sense, and this goes across region and across race and across political party. We grew up with this idea that we were supposed to do better than our parents, that every generation has been upwardly mobile. And of course, we will be too. And especially if we work hard enough, there's nothing in the way of girls becoming astronauts and what have you. And then I think we've all faced some disappointment, many of us, at this stage of life. And so I worked really hard to make sure that the women I interviewed really looked like America, so that there are a couple hundred women, there are a lot of women of color. I think I got every state. There are Democrats and Republicans. There are people who go to church and go to synagogue and are atheists. Like I think it's really important to point out what we have in common.
You do that really, really well. So talk a little bit about your methodology. How did you find these women?
Well, it was actually great to do that story for Oprah.com first, because
they found you.
Well, after the story, hundreds of them did. But even going into the story, I was able to use their social media channels to send out a questionnaire pretty far and wide. I reached like thousands of women that way. And then I had them fill out answer these questions. And then I got a Google Doc populated with all these things. So I was able to go through and pick a lot of women that I wanted to interview in person. And I also used message boards and I sort of tried to identify where the holes were. So, you know, if I didn't have anyone in Texas, I went out of my way to go find some Texas women, you know.
Tell me about any surprises that you stumbled upon.
I was really surprised by the commonality of the language that women used across all of these boundaries. So
give me some examples.
So multiple women said the words to me, "What did I do wrong?" And, you know, one said, like, you know, "I always thought I was going to have this amazing career by now. You know, what did I do wrong that I don't have that?" And then, of course, her she's holding a baby. There's two little kids running around.
So it's a matter of perception as much as anything else.
What I kept seeing was everyone was seeing what they didn't have,
right,
and not what they did have. And that was pretty much across the board something that I saw.
How interesting that is.
Well, I really focused on people who were having a hard time. So success for them was pretty much always elusive, was my experience. So they really saw these they didn't see the obstacles in their way. They just saw their own inability to have achieved them. So that's one thing I keep hearing now, is that the people who read the book are like, "Oh, there was like a context for all of this. There were reasons why." I mean, for example, 40% of us were children of divorce, and that meant a lot of people didn't get college paid for. So you can be told, reach for the stars, but if there's no support behind you, then do you really have to punish yourself for not having reached the stars?
Well, you know, we mentioned Gail Sheehy before, and what's so impressive is that this book has struck a chord the way Passages struck a chord, or the way books before that have as well. It's been a remarkable seller. It was beautifully published. And having your voice out there, I think, is very comforting, probably, to to all those women who you didn't interview and who never kind of put it all together. So what have you heard from women since this book has been published?
I just got, so every day I get this flood of emails, and I got one today from a woman that I know who said that it was like that scene in Good Will Hunting where Robin Williams is hugging Matt Damon saying, "It's not your fault, it's not your fault, it's not your fault," over and over again. And I kind of like that.
What a great mantra that.
So I'm honored to be, to have that. I mean, I think a lot of women just wanted to not feel ashamed. Like, and I think that they shouldn't. Like, there is no shame in not having done something impossible. So my mother was an actress. She was in the movie Urban Cowboy as John Travolta's aunt. So that was my first Coca-Cola was on John Travolta's lap at Gillies on the set. And so she was in a lot of commercials and some TV and some movies. And then my dad was the art critic for the Village Voice. And then, of course, he went on to become the art critic for the New Yorker. His name is Peter Sheldahl.
Right.
So I kind of
didn't. We've sold many of his books at the bookstore. I'll tell him, he'll be happy. Please do.
I didn't want to do what he did. I was sort of running away from writing for a long time. And I worked at magazines because I babysat all the time. And a lot of the parents of the kids I babysat for worked in magazines. So they'd be like, "When you're done here, go to the office and transcribe all my interviews." And so I wound up working at Esquire and Spin and some business magazines as like a copy editor, fact checker, you know, Girl Friday.
We were talking earlier about what happened in the house that you grew up in just recently.
Oh, yeah.
You want to tell us about that?
Sure. Boy, this fall has been terrible. My dad was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Mm. And then a month later, a fire started in the apartment below them on St. Mark's Place and destroyed his whole office and the whole back of the apartment and really much of the building.
So terrible.
It's been rather unpleasant.
So you've been a caregiver.
Yes.
You've been the advocate for your
yes.
for someone who's ill. I think that bridges all age groups,
yeah.
all generations. I mean, I know it's something that, you know, people my age have been going through now as baby boomers
yes.
and dealing with our parents. And I think nobody trains you for that ever.
That's right. And nobody talks about it. I think you just, you know, somebody just vanishes for 5 years. You're like, where did they go? Well, maybe their parent got sick or their sister or something.
So I know that you do have a character in the book. You don't name their names, right?
Uh-huh.
And one of them is Florida Girl, in a sense, right?
There is a Florida Girl, yes.
And why don't you tell us a little, since we're in Florida, tell us a little bit about her.
She's very beautiful. She's, you may know her. She basically told me my favorite quote in the whole book, which is she was talking about how it's terrible, right? All these things you're dealing with at this stage of life. And she dealt with divorce. She dealt with, you know, money stuff. She dealt with health stuff. And that basically, like, it's all terrible, but she'd started to see it also as sort of fun. And then she said this, it's terrible fun. And I just loved that expression. I thought it's so Gen X also, just this way of being like, yep, it's awful, but you find a way to find joy and humor inside the awfulness.
For some reason, I have a feeling that's the way she approaches life.
I think
right?
that is.
I think so. I also love the fact that each chapter you start with a little bit of a quote from somebody that you've talked to.
Yeah.
So it gives it a sense of life.
And in the audiobook, I use the actual voices of the women.
So
little clips from
because
the
you
interviews.
Had recorded the interviews.
I recorded the interviews.
Would you like to read a little bit?
Oh, I'd be happy
for
to.
Us.
Yeah.
I would love to have you
do
that.
Do you have something you'd like me to read? Or
well, you know, I love the introduction.
Well, let's do
if
that.
You want to just start at the introduction, because I think it.
Sure. One woman I know had everything she'd ever wanted: a loving partner, two children, a career she cared about, even the freedom to make her own schedule. But she still couldn't shake a feeling of profound despair. She spent months getting a babysitter for her toddler daughter in the middle of the day, using the time to go alone to noon movies where she sat in the dark and cried. A former coworker told me that her impressive LinkedIn profile was misleading. In truth, she was underemployed and for years since her last layoff had been taking one low-paying gig after another. She's unmarried, never had kids, and while that part is okay with her, she has started dreading her upcoming 50th birthday, having realized that she will probably never own her own home and has saved nowhere near enough for retirement. A neighbor with a small army of adorable young children was doing part-time work she enjoyed. Her kid's father was a friendly, hardworking man. She was baffled by the rage she had come to feel toward him. She'd begun to imagine that divorce she might have a better shot at happiness. "I'd leave," she said to me one day when I asked how things were going, "if I had more money." Another woman told me she had started to fear that she would die alone. Just like her married friends, she'd gotten a good education and had a good job, had made a nice home and was staying in shape, but somehow she'd never found a partner or had children. She woke up in the middle of the night wondering if she should have married her college boyfriend, if she should freeze her eggs, if she should have a baby alone, if she should do more or less online dating, and just how much more she could take of her friend's sons and daughters smiling on social media before she threw her laptop out the window. An acquaintance told me she'd been having a rough time working 3 jobs as a single mother since her husband left her. Determined to cheer up her family, she planned a weekend trip. After a long week, she started packing at 10 p.m., figuring she could catch a few hours of sleep before their 5 a.m. departure. She asked her 11-year-old son to start gathering his stuff. He didn't move. She asked again. Nothing. "If you don't help," she told him, "I'm going to smash your iPad." He still didn't move. As if possessed, she grabbed a hammer and whacked the iPad to pieces. When she told me this, I thought of how many parents I know who have fantasized or threatened this very thing, and here she had actually done it. I laughed. "Yeah, my friends think it's a hilarious story too," she said, "but in reality, it was dark and awful." Her first thought as she stood over the broken glass, "I have to find a good therapist right now."
That's great. That's really great. Ada Calhoun, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for being on The Literary Life. I can't thank you enough.
Great honor. Thank you for the podcast.